It was easier to shift his camp to the mapani tree under which Santan lay than move her to the camp. He had to carry the child with him, but he managed it in less than 20 minutes. He was fearful every minute that he left the helpless mother alone, and vastly relieved when he led the packhorse back to where she lay. Santan was still unconscious, and the child he carried had sold itself and was ravenous with hunger. He wiped off the boy's small pink bottom with a handful of dry grass, remembering how he had performed the same service for his own son, and then placed him under the greatcoat where he could reach his unconscious mother's breast. Then he set a canteen of water on a small fire and dropped the curved sacking needle and a hank of white cotton thread from his canvas housewife into the boiling water to sterilize. He washed his own hands in a mug of hot water and carbolic soap, emptied the mug, refilled it, and began to scrub out the deep tears in the girl's calf. The water was painfully hot, and he lathered carbolic soap and forced his finger to the bottom of each wound, poured hot water into it, and then washed it out again and again. Santan moaned and thrashed about weakly, but he held her down and scrubbed grimly at the fearful lacerations. At last, not truly satisfied, but certain that if he persisted in his rough cleansing he would do irreparable damage to delicate tissue, he went to his saddlebag and fetched a whiskey bottle which he had carried with him for 4 years. It had been given to him by the German Lutheran missionary doctor who had nursed him through the wounds he had received during the campaign against Smuts and Buddha's invasion. "It may save your life one day," the doctor had told him. The handwritten label was illegible now. Acriflavin. With an effort he remembered the name, and the dark, yellow-brown liquid had evaporated to half its volume. He poured it into the open wounds and worked it with his forefinger, making certain that it reached the bottom of each deep cut. He used the last drops from the bottle on the rent in Santan's scalp. He fished the needle and cotton from the boiling canteen. With the girl's leg in his lap, he took a deep breath. "Thank the Lord, she's unconscious." And he held the lips of raw flesh together and worked the point of the needle through them. It took him nearly 2 hours to sew the meat of her tattered calf together again, and his stitches were crude but effective, the work of a sailmaker rather than a surgeon. He used strips from one of his clean shirts to bind up the leg, but as he worked he knew that despite his best efforts, infection was almost certain. He transferred his attention to her scalp. 3 stitches were sufficient to close that wound, and afterwards the nervous strain of the last 2 hours swamped him, and he felt shaken and exhausted. It took an effort of will to begin work on the litter. He skinned out the carcass of the lion and strung the wet hide between 2 long limber mapani saplings with the fur side uppermost. The horses shied and fidgeted at the rank smell of lion, but he gentled them and fitted the straight poles of the drag litter onto the packhorse, then tenderly lifted Santan's limp body, wrapped in the greatcoat, into the litter and strapped her securely with strips of mapani bark. Carrying the now sleeping child in the satchel and leading the packhorse with the litter sliding along behind it, he set off at a walk towards the wagons. He calculated that it was a full day's march and it was now long past noon, but he could not force the pace without risk of injuring the girl in the litter. A little before sundown, Shasa woke and howled like a hungry wolf. Lothar hobbled the horses and took him to his mother. Within minutes, Shasa was howling with frustration and kicking under the flap of the greatcoat, presenting Lothar with a difficult decision. "It's for the child, and she will never know," he decided. He lifted the flap of the greatcoat and hesitated again before touching her so intimately. "Forgive me, please." He apologized to the unconscious girl and took her bared breast in his hand. The weight and the heat and velvet feel of it was a shock in his loins, but he tried to ignore it. He pressed and kneaded, with Shasa blustering and mouthing furiously at his hand, and then rocked back on his heels and covered Santan with the coat. "Now what the hell do we do, boy? Your mother's lost her milk." He picked Shasa up. "No, don't try me, my friend. This is another dry house, I'm afraid. We'll have to camp here while I go shopping." He cut thorn branches and dragged them into a circular lager to keep out hyena or other predators and built a large fire in the center. "You'll have to come with me," he said to the querulous infant, and strapping the canvas bag across his shoulder, he rode out on his hunting horse. He found a herd of zebra around the next bluff of the mountain. Using his horse as a screen, he worked to within easy rifle shot of the herd and picked out a mare with a young foal at her side. He hit her cleanly in the head, and she dropped instantly. When he walked up to the dead zebra, the foal ran only a few yards and then circled back. "Sorry, old fellow," Lothar said to it. The orphan would have no chance of survival, and the bullet he gave it in the head was swift mercy. Lothar knelt beside the dead mare and pulled back her top leg to expose the swollen black udders. He was able to draw half a canteen of warm milk from her. It was rich and topped with thick yellow cream. He diluted it with an equal quantity of warm water and soaked a folded square of cotton torn from his shirt into the mixture. Shasa spluttered and kicked and turned his head away, but Lothar persisted. "This is the only item on the menu." Suddenly Shasa learned the trick of it. Milk dribbled down his chin, but some of it went down his throat, and he yelled impatiently every time Lothar pulled the wad of shirt out of his mouth to re-soak it. Lothar slept that night with Shasa against his chest and woke before dawn when the child demanded his breakfast. There was zebra milk remaining from the previous evening. By the time he had fed the boy and then washed him in a mug of water warmed on the fire, it was after sunrise. When Lothar set him down, Shasa set off at a gallop on his hands and knees towards the horses, giving breathless cries of excitement. Lothar felt that swollen feeling in his chest that he had not known since the death of his own son, and lifted him onto the horse's back. Shasa kicked and gurgled with laughter, and the hunting pony reached back and snuffled at him with ears pricked. "We'll make a horseman of you before you walk," Lothar laughed. However, when he went to San Tan's litter and tried gently to rouse her, his concern was intense. She was still unconscious, though she moaned and rolled her head from side to side when he touched the leg. It was swollen and bruised, and clotted blood had dried on the stitches. "My God, what a mess," he whispered. But when he searched for the livid lines of gangrene up her thigh, he found none. There was another unpleasant discovery, however. Santan needed the same attention as her son. He undressed her quickly. The canvas skirt and mantle were her only clothing, and he tried to remain unmoved and clinical when he looked at her. He could not do so. Up to this time, Lothar had based his concept of feminine beauty on the placid, round, blonde, Rubenesque charms of his mother, and after her, his wife, Emilia. Now he found his standards abruptly overturned. This woman was lean as a greyhound, with a tucked-in belly in which you could see the separate muscles clearly defined beneath the skin. That skin, even where it was untouched by the sun, was cream rather than pure milk. Her body hair, instead of being pale and wispy, was thick and dark and curly. Her limbs were long and willowy, not round and dimpled at elbow and knee. She was firm to the touch. His fingers did not sink into her flesh as they had into other flesh he had known, and where the sun had reached her legs and arms and face, she was the colour of lightly oiled teak. He tried not to dwell upon these things as he rolled her deftly but gently onto her face. But when he saw that her buttocks were round and hard and white as a perfect pair of ostrich eggs, Something flopped in his stomach, and his hands shook uncontrollably as he finished cleaning her. He experienced no revulsion at the task. It was as natural as his attentions to the child had been, and afterwards he wrapped her in the greatcoat again and squatted on his heels beside her to examine her face minutely. Again, he found her features differed from his previous conception of feminine beauty. The halo of thick, kinky dark hair was almost African. Those black eyebrows were too stark, her chin too thrusting and stubborn. The whole cast and set of her features was far too assertive to bear comparison with the gentle compliance of those other women. Even though she was totally relaxed, Lothar could still read on her face the marks of great suffering and hardship, perhaps as great as his own, and as he touched the smooth brown cheek, he felt almost fatalistically drawn to her, as though it had been ordained from that first glimpse of her so many months before. Abruptly, he shook his head with annoyance and a quick sense of his own ridiculous sentimentality. "I know nothing of you, or you of me." He looked up quickly, and with a guilty start realized that the child had crawled away under the horse's hooves. With chuckles of glee, he was snatching at their inquisitive, puffing nostrils as they stretched down to him, sniffing at him. Leading the pack horse and carrying the child, Lothar reached his wagons late that same afternoon.